Okay, I'll make a few concluding remarks, and then we'll go to question and answer. I'd like to deal with an aspect of the problem which Gareth touched on a bit, but I think many people go to the regime change, the Iraq situation, and Gareth was very eloquent in his discussion of that. But I think, you know, there's widespread opposition to the Iraq war now by two-thirds of the American people. They think it's a it was a mistake. And many people don't think it was part of the war on terror, even though the administration lumped it in with that. And, of course, for the reasons that Gareth just mentioned. Even the Democrats have bought into the war on terror at home that Ian discussed, and also, again, in other places, including Afghanistan. And I'm going to say a few words about that, because I think the occupation of Afghanistan gets way too much support here in the United States. Even the Democrats are saying, well, you know, we need to get rid of the Iraq thing, withdraw the troops, because we're really losing the war on Afghanistan, or we're in danger of losing it, and we've got to get over there and get the troops over there and win that, because it's more important. And I agree that getting bin Laden has always been more important than Iraq, but I'm not sure the Afghan occupation really helps with that. I think, in my own view, is taking down the Taliban may have been an appropriate goal after 9/11, because they were providing a haven for al-Qaeda. But the problem is that the United States always has to engage in mission creep. And the United States, in my view, should have withdrawn from Afghanistan and told the Afghans that they could, you know, have any type of government that they wanted, as long as they didn't reinstall the Taliban or have a government that sheltered al-Qaeda, or the U.S. would be back with a vengeance. The problem with the continuing U.S. occupation is the same problem in Iraq. You have a non-Muslim foreign occupier that's occupying a Muslim country. And, of course, this has caused the rise of radical elements and the consequent destabilization of Pakistan, and is doing it to this day. And if you doubt that this is happening because of this reason, the non-Muslim occupation of Muslim lands is a derivative of Robert Pape's documented thesis that getting rid of a democratic foreign occupier is what suicide bombing is all about. And he has many examples of that in his book. And non-Muslim occupation of Muslim land is a major cause of violence in the U.S. occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, as I mentioned, the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, the Russian occupation of Chechnya, the Ethiopian occupation of Somalia, and the Israeli occupation of Palestine. It's the same in all these places. And we've experienced mission creep in Afghanistan, from getting bin Laden and company to the Herculean task of stabilizing Afghanistan, nation building there, and even eradicating drugs. And of course, the effort to eradicate drugs is very popular here at home, but it interferes with the stabilization mission, because if you're eradicating farmers' crops, either by doing it on the ground as we're doing it now, or spraying as the U.S. would like to do, of course, all these farmers don't tend to be too sympathetic, because that's their livelihood. So, of course, they go in and become closer to the Taliban, and the Taliban enriches itself from protecting poppy crops from the U.S. and the Afghan government's eradication efforts. So this is an example where the mission creep has really gotten out of hand. And of course, this anti-drug mission, you can even question that the war on drugs here in the United States. It's a bit like the war on terrorism, and the war on poverty, and any other thing that's been labeled a war. When it's labeled a war, you better guard your wallet, because the war on poverty didn't produce many results, and the war on drugs is wasting buckets of money in the tens of billions per year, and of course the war on terror is questionable, as our first two speakers have mentioned. So instead of going overboard at home and abroad on the counterproductive, broad, and very public war on terror, perhaps the U.S. should have countered al-Qaeda with the U.S. judicial system, law enforcement efforts, and intelligence services. Now, I'm not necessarily opposed to using the military against al-Qaeda. On the rare occasion when force is needed overseas to capture or kill al-Qaeda, it should be done in the shadows with special forces and covert operatives. I think anytime you're waging a public war on terror, you're losing because you're creating more terrorists. And I think Donald Rumsfeld really realized this. You know, in one of his snowflakes, he asked the question, are we creating more terrorists than we're getting rid of? And I think he very clearly understood. He didn't want to put anything down in writing to say that was definitely true, but his question, of course, raised many, many other questions. And so I think running the very public war with the military force as the predominant weapon merely increases the number of al-Qaeda recruits. I think it's similar to using excessive warfare in counterinsurgency or excessive force in counterinsurgency operations. It's tempting to do that, to just go in and blast away, but I think the military in both Afghanistan and Iraq is learning again that that's not a good idea. And the same is true with terrorists. If you use a force in public, you're going to get more of a pushback from the terrorists. This happened in the 1980s when Reagan was jousting with Muammar Gaddafi. The conventional wisdom is that Reagan put him in his box with the 1986 airstrikes and other things. But if you look at the historical record, and I have, Gaddafi actually increased his terrorism. He just went underground, did it surreptitiously. He sponsored attacks through other groups around the world against U.S. targets. Of course, one of them killed a lot of people on an airline. This idea that public uses of force maybe it may help politicians and that sort of thing, but if you really want to fight this, even if you use military force, it should probably be without creating more terrorists. Now, you'll note that I've been saying al-Qaeda rather than the word terrorists because after 9/11, the administration also started going after other groups on the U.S. terrorism list and countries that sponsored them, as Gareth mentioned, Saddam's Iraq being one of them, the most prominent. Now, one thing about this effort, though, is that most groups on the U.S. terrorism list don't attack the United States and have more local concerns. Most jihadists have local concerns. Now, I always say there's no need to target them and make more enemies. If the groups don't attack the U.S., or if the governments don't sponsor groups that attack the U.S., like Saddam's Iraq didn't sponsor terrorists that attack the U.S., North Korea, they're still putting it on the terrorism list for political reasons. The last terrorist that attacked was blowing up a Korean airliner in the late 1980s. And, of course, Cuba. We keep that on the terrorism list for political reasons. Cuba doesn't really sponsor terrorism anymore. They did at one time, but they don't anymore. So perhaps they should be removed from the terrorism list and left alone. As Ian alluded to, the U.S. government and military-industrial complex is many times al-Qaeda's best friend. By this threat exaggeration and widening the U.S. list of enemies to scare its own population to get the money for defense, security, law enforcement programs, and other powers, it magnifies the effect of the terrorist effort to use a few tactics to scare everybody. That's what terrorism is. Terrorists operate on a low budget. They want to choose their attacks very carefully, and they want to induce the maximum fear. Now, of course, the federal government's color-coded terrorism alert system is an example. If you go into the metro, you'll see this color-coded thing, and they have a little narrative by each color. And the other day I was in the metro, I thought, oh, maybe they're finally going to tell the public what they're supposed to do at each level. And, of course, they don't. They just said, you know, the general thing is have a plan in case there's an attack, is what the public is supposed to do. So there's no... You don't know what you're supposed to do at yellow, orange, or red. And, of course, the system has been mostly toggling between yellow and orange because the government will not put it on green or blue because if there's an attack, the government will be blamed for being asleep. And they don't put it on red because then everybody would stay at home and not go shopping at the mall. So therefore, we have this political terrorism. But this is an example of, I think, where the government is actually aiding the terrorists because it's creating unnecessary fear. Now, Ian was giving some examples of absurd things that he went across. And I, this is not an attack on President Bush because I went to a conference in the late Clinton administration that was put on by Jane's, which is a military magazine. It's the foremost military magazine. And I thought, you know, it was going to be, I was naive. I was working in the terrorism area at the time, though, and so I thought, well, I'm going to go and hear a lot about the threat, which threats are the most severe and that sort of thing. And I got there, and it was Jane's telling all these, it's mainly government people from agencies, non-security agencies like NIH and all these other agencies, that how to get government funding for their projects and how to spin their grants so that, you know, NIH, if they were doing biological research, they had to make it related to biological weapons. Because at the time, Bill Clinton had read this book on some novel about biological weapons, and he got really interested in this. So if you remember, clear back in the late Clinton administration, these terrorism scares started because chemical and biological weapons were all over the CNN and the other news channels because the president became interested in the threat. So, of course, all these people were trying to get government get their more funding for their agency's efforts. And it was quite an astounding thing. Even before 9/11, this was occurring. Now, what is the actual threat? Well, Ian was mentioning that it's not as great as being portrayed. And I think if you look at statistics, which I always like to look at statistics because people, social scientists have a term called probability neglect. And the public has probability neglect. In other words, they're more scared of getting AIDS or getting struck by terrorism than they are driving 75 miles down the freeway without a seatbelt, which is, of course, much more dangerous than any of those things. So John Mueller, a political scientist at Ohio State University in foreign affairs a year or so ago, I think, I can't remember the exact issue date, he calculated that the average American has a 1 in 80,000 chance of ever being killed by an international terrorist during their lifetime. Now, of course, if they don't live abroad, or if they don't live in Washington, D.C. or New York, the chances are even much lower than that. Most anti-U.S. terrorist attacks occur overseas at U.S. embassies, military bases, that sort of thing, not here at home. In fact, I went back many years and looked at the, before they discontinued the report, before it got too embarrassing after the terrorism spiked after 9/11, that there was a report called The Patterns of Global Terrorism by the State Department. And if you went through all those reports year after year, you quickly found that North America always had the lowest numbers of attacks, like zero or one, or most years not any at all. So when the president tells us that our great efforts at counterterrorism and anti-terrorism have led to this to no attacks since 9/11, you have to say, well, you know, that's kind of like saying, well, I haven't been struck by lightning today. I mean, because it's a terrorist strike is a rare event. The last major one before that in the U.S. was in 1993 at the same building, the World Trade Center attack. So, of course, the bureaucracy would turn that around and say, well, we better be careful. You know, it's been 8 years since, it was 8 years between those two attacks, and next year is the eighth year. But, of course, we know that terrorism is not regular like that. But the point is, in North America, it's very hard for terrorists to operate. They have a long logistical line of supply. There are not a lot of radical groups to provide cover, et cetera. And so I think we have to put the threat into perspective. And I think there's a self-protection instinct in humans that makes them risk-averse. So then that's why you have probability neglect, because of biological and it's in the genes of humans to stay alive. And so they're risk-averse. And when the government and when the government and the security bureaucracies tell them, well, you must be aware and must be scared about these things, of course, they're going to be scared. And we were mentioning, Gareth was mentioning some of these things that are justified on the basis of the war on terror. I mean, most the war on terror is fairly cheap to fight in military terms. You have intelligence, need special forces, drones, maybe more human intelligence agents in the CIA and military. But we're building three fighter aircrafts, new submarines, new destroyers, a future combat system, which is a follow-on to a tank. And many of these things don't really have a role in fighting terrorism or a marginal role. Now, it's fine if we need these things for other reasons, but, you know, the budget has been pumped up on the basis of the fears of security, on the basis of the fears of Al-Qaeda and that sort of thing, more terrorist attack. So, of course, getting rid of the war moniker would help reduce terrorism, save money, and avoid turning our country into a police state. But getting rid of the war term must also be accompanied by less use of public military force and more reliance on law enforcement, intelligence, and on the rare occasion, military action in the shadows. And I also think the U.S. should concentrate on Al-Qaeda, the people that are attacking us, which seems to be a basic point in military strategy and tactics, is that you want to focus on the person or the country or the group that attacked you and not everyone else. I always say that if Bush would have been president in 1941 and the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor and the Nazis declared war on us, he would have attacked Argentina, which makes no sense at all. So I think we have to fight the enemy that is attacking us. And we're only falling into bin Laden's trap by going into Iraq. And I also think we're falling into bin Laden's trap by continuing the occupation of Afghanistan and trying to nation build there. We can go after bin Laden without doing that. And I'm not big on the failed state thesis because I think more empirical studies have to be done, but just because states are in the failed state category, it doesn't necessarily mean they're havens for terrorism. So given the statistically low odds of an attack, it seems that as bad as the occasional contingent terrorist attack may be, we may have more to fear from the government's permanent response to it than the actual terrorism itself. I once had a colleague, I was working in the military security bureaucracy, and I was back in the 80s, and I was a hardliner on terrorism. And I had a friend, and we would always argue, and there was some terrorist attack against a U.S. facility overseas. And I would have said, you know, we got to go after him and everything. And he said to me, he said, you know, I think the best thing to do would be to do nothing. And I go, well, you know, Dave, how can you say this? You know, they've just bombed our embassy or whatever. And he goes, well, you know, terrorism want the publicity. They want to make people fearful. And if you don't give them the publicity, you know, you're denying them one of the things that they really want. And when we attack back, they get publicity from that. And I can't remember which of our speakers said it, but I guess it was Ian that said, we're granting them a place on the stage with our own country. It's sort of like the challenger to an incumbent president. When he's on the debate stage with the president, he's also gaining stature by the fact that he's on the debate stage with the president. Now, if you're running for president, you usually can't avoid debating somebody. But in this particular case, we can't avoid very public reactions to terrorism. And I'm not saying that we should do nothing about this, because obviously it's politically impossible. Any president after 9/11 had to do something. And it's also institutionally as impossible, as Gareth was mentioning. But I do think if we have a president in the wake of 9/11 who would have been responsible, he would have tried to have a much more measured response rather than taking advantage of it to make the situation worse. And I think that's really what we need to do. We need to have a measured response and a fairly low-key and in the shadows response. So I'll just end there, and we'll turn it over to question and answer now.